I'm Afshin Ratansi. We're going underground as Chinese communist leader Xi Jinping visits France hours after the 19th consecutive Gilets Jaunes uprising. Coming up in the show, our NATO nation economic wars on countries from Venezuela to Iran to Syria, illegal under international law. We ask the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Sanctions, Ambassador Idriss Jazeera. And will the war ever end as the Yemeni conflict enters its fifth year? We ask UK NGO Reprieve's Bara Shiban, the man arrested in Britain under the Terrorism Act, for his political views about the true cost of UK-backed bombs. Plus, the great NHS heist, 21 days before GPs sign a contract that could change the NHS forever. We speak to GP Dr. Bob Gill about the neoliberal politicians and private companies that are robbing the taxpayer. All this and more coming up in today's Going Underground. But first, while Brexit paralyzes the UK, Britain, like the EU, continues to engage in economic warfare with countries all around the world. Called sanctions in mainstream media, are they actually illegal? Can the Bank of England really just withhold Venezuelan gold and the US sanction Iranian banks? Joining me now via Skype from Geneva is the man who should know. Ambassador Idriss Jazeera is at the UN. Rapporteur, welcome to Going Underground. We'd better begin with what the job title is, Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures. It's clearly about life and death, but what's in that title?
It's a mission which is quite sensitive because it looks into the adverse human rights impact of unilateral sanctions. That is, those sanctions which are considered to be illegitimate according to international law, those sanctions which are not the result of a decision of the Security Council.
Every other day on the media we hear of Britain or a NATO nation, say, or the EU, putting sanctions on another country. You're saying the only legitimate way of sanctioning another country is with a UN Security Council resolution.
That is correct. But one must realize that this is an important issue which is underestimated by public opinion, because today I could say that at least a quarter of humanity, a quarter of the people of the world live in countries which are targeted by sanctions. So it's a major problem. It has an impact on the enjoyment of human rights by so many hundreds of millions of people, and yet there is no UN accountability for these the implementation of these sanctions.
Well, let's go to some of the cases. As you say, a quarter of humanity. The United States has clearly violated the nuclear agreement with Iran, for instance. Britain and the European Union are against the U.S. violation. But then, does that mean that the U.S. sanctions against Iran are also in contravention of the international law?
Doubly so, because, as I said, for the reasons I mentioned, that was already in contravention of international law. In addition to that, there is an agreement now that was taken that the JCPOA, as they call it, which is an agreement that if Iran stops developing the nuclear weapons, that all sanctions by Western countries would be lifted. Now, all countries are doing that, but the U.S. has decided to withdraw from it. And the problem here is that there have been statements by the United States to the effect that those sanctions will be the most constraining ones in the world. So that means that the people of Iran are going to be submitted to a terrible pressure and to enormous sufferings. And I don't think this is fair. It's okay if you have a disagreement with a political leadership to try and sort it out with them, or probably to negotiate a solution. But to make the people pay is not fair. And in any event, when people are submitted to such destitution because of outside sanctions, they usually rally around the flag. Look at what happened in Cuba. There were sanctions for 50 years, but that didn't change the regime. The same applies to the Sudan, and I would like to say here that I do express my deep gratitude to the United States for having finally accepted to lift the sanctions against Sudan. My mandate was engaged on that. with the Obama administration already, but the process was concluded by the present administration, and that is a testimony to what quiet diplomacy can achieve.
If there has been some success over Bashir in Sudan, what happens to you in the office when you hear the news that someone like Federica Mogherini of the European Union stands up and says, right, the European Union, we're going to choose who's president of Venezuela, kind of, and tell the oil superpower there is going to be sanctions on Venezuela?
Well, I'm intending to go to Venezuela in the near future to see for myself what can be done in order to ensure that there is humanitarian access for the people of Venezuela. Even I don't say that the situation under the present administration is perfect. They all have their learning by doing to a certain extent. But nevertheless, the people should not be made to pay for any shortcomings by their government. So I intend to go there. I know there's a lot of media hype about the situation in Venezuela. People, if you read the Western press, are all starving and they're deprived of everything. The Venezuelan administration tells us that their people are surviving painfully, but they are not in a state of famine. So I need to go there to see what is the real situation. But I do believe that in these questions, no grandstanding from me will be of any use. What I can do is to be a catalyzer, to help the parties concerned on both sides to find a solution.
Okay, but your contention is that the EU has committed a unilateral coercive measure in sanctioning Venezuela without a UN Security Council resolution?
Of course, all those that are applying sanctions on Venezuela should carry out a human impact assessment review to make sure that when they apply these sanctions, they're not making the situation worse for ordinary citizens. Whether it's in Venezuela or whether in Syria, I can't take the argument that is invoked by source countries of sanctions who say we are deciding to apply or to extend our sanctions on country A or B because of the failure of the government to ensure proper respect of human rights. By applying sanctions, which will deprive people of food, medication, humanitarian supplies, we are, in fact, adding to the exacerbating the human rights impact that we criticize from the country targeted.
But then, of course, those that want to overthrow different governments in NATO nations would say you're giving carte blanche to any UN Security Council member for making all sanctions illegal. Obviously, Britain has been sanctioning Russia increasingly since the British government has alleged that President Putin has been ordering assassinations here. Are those sanctions against Russia illegal, and what effect are those sanctions having in changing Russia?
Well, let's start with the positive aspect. I refer to the case of Rusal. Rusal is one of the world's largest producers of aluminium. It has companies not only in Russia, but in several other countries. The sanctions applied by the U.S. were affecting the lives of 70,000 or more employees and tens of thousands of members of their families. So I appealed at the Human Rights Council last summer, and again at the General Assembly in October last year, for the United States to review this situation and to find some adjustments, perhaps in the board of directors of Rusal, so as not to make the innocent employees have to pay, not only in Russia, but in Jamaica or elsewhere, have to pay for this dispute. And this is what happened recently. So that calls for an expression of appreciation to the U.S. for having responded and made this lifted the sanctions on Musa. Now, there are some other sanctions which are applied on the Russia, Nord Stream 2 from Russia to Germany, is the subject of extraterritorial sanctions by the United States. And it is the problem that even the EU questions the right of a country not only to sanction the target country, but also to compel its allies to also apply their domestic law, the initial country's domestic law, on the third country. This is what they call extraterritorial extension of domestic sanctions.
We'll have to get John Bolton on, Donald Trump's national security advisor, to see what plans are against Chancellor Merkel of Germany over Nord Stream. But can I just finally ask you about the benefits of, I mean, you're the special rapporteur on the negative impact. Can there be sometimes a positive impact of the unilateral coercive measures? Last week, Iran, Iraq, Syria, they met in Damascus to convene to oppose the U.S. role in the region. We know that China and Russia, countries both sanctioned by European Union countries, are moving closer together. Can sanctions sometimes bring countries together against dominant nations, more like the non-aligned movement almost, out of sanctions?
As I said earlier, when you apply sanctions to a country, you usually consolidate the government that you're trying to destabilize. I mentioned the case of Cuba. I could also mention the case of the Sudan. It's interesting to see that it was after the sanctions were lifted that the government of Sudan started having to confront demonstrations from its population asking for an improvement in their conditions of living. So this is the lesson. Hey, you guys, if you want to change a political system in the country, the last thing you should do is to apply sanctions, because you're likely, by through that process, to consolidate the system that you are trying to challenge.
Special Rapporteur, thank you. After the break. When will the world's worst humanitarian crisis ever end? We speak to a consultant to the Yemen embassy here in London. And NHS emergency. We investigate the private companies going in for the kill under the cover of Brexit chaos. All this and more coming up in part two of Going Underground. Welcome back. Tomorrow's 5 years since the war began in Yemen, now the world's worst humanitarian crisis with 20 million people at risk. I'm joined now by a consultant to the Yemen embassy in London, Bara Shaban. He's a caseworker, Middle East caseworker for UK NGO Reprieve. Bara, thanks for coming on. Many people might be surprised there is a Yemen mission of any kind in Britain. The way we see it on the news is this is just an unbridled, almost natural humanitarian crisis. How do you see the Yemen war progressing now into its fifth year?
Well, I think starting from this point, one of the main issues that have been happening on Yemen, that the Yemeni voices are not being heard. The main, I think, debate that is happening here in the UK is really the relationship between the United Kingdom and Saudi Arabia, not developing a Yemen policy that is really focusing on what is happening in Yemen and why are we in this conflict that the UN can't resolve, the Jeremy Hunt can't resolve.
Well, arguably there is some kind of ceasefire holding in Hodeidah port, where our great Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt even visited Britain, of course, giving some of the most aid in the world to Yemen.
So let's talk about the ceasefire. So what happened is that the both parties signed the Stockholm Agreement in late December. What happened is that then the Houthis were able to redeploy their forces to the province of Hajjah in the north of Yemen. And they escalated a big, big conflict that has been happening for the last 2 months. And now I know the area because I visited this area in 2013 as part of my role in the National Dialogues. I was representing the youth delegation who were coming from the Arab Spring protests, simply. So in 2013, there was a National Dialogue bringing together the new constitution, and we were supposed to have elections and the referendum in 2015. before the Houthis did the unfortunate events of the coup, which basically tipped the situation and drove their country.
So you wanted things to remain the same under the Saudi-backed, well, widely seen as dictatorship?
Well, the situation, you need to understand what was happening in Yemen in 2013 and 2014 to understand why are we in a conflict today. We had a national dialogue where everyone participated, including the Houthis, and we came out with the transitional justice deal and the new constitution. We called for the referendum and the new elections, but because at the end of 2014, the Houthis felt they don't need this deal anymore. They don't need to come for the referendum anymore because now they have been more empowered. So they took over the capital by force. This basically drove
the country. They wanted a revolution.
Well, I mean, basically call it whatever you want. It is a coup at the end of the day. Then they attempted an assassination attempt on the life of President Hadi. This basically, in the terms of the basic sense, if you try to kill a president, you will tip the situation, you know, you're going to cause a conflict.
You don't think most of the country of Yemen wanted Hadi gone? Or even tried?
Well, then
with the death penalty.
Well, then get him out by in the coming elections. The conservatives want to protect their relationship with Saudi Arabia, and they think it's good for this country.
As has the Labour government.
And the Labour government, to be afraid of. But today, then you have people like Jeremy Corbyn or Emily Thornberry criticizing this policy, mainly about their relationship with Saudi Arabia. Again, Yemen as the country, what's happening in Yemen? Why are we not having a successful peace deal? This is not being discussed. When you have a ceasefire over the port of Hodeidah, and then it escalates in another part of the country, so you made the successful ceasefire in one part, but then there is no guarantees to the rest of the population what's going to happen to them.
Then Saudi forces can blockade the port and lead to mass malnutrition and death.
No, you need to have a comprehensive approach to the situation. The main topic that is not being discussed, why are we in a conflict today? And again, I bring back to you the situation in 2014 and 2015. We had a transitional justice deal. We had a new constitution.
Is that really the reason? Or is it because Western powers, NATO nations, supported Hadi, wanted to create a proxy in Yemen, which is of crucial geopolitical
Hadi's
importance.
Hadi's times in office were numbered at that time.
Right. If,
when he called for the referendum and the elections, his days in office were numbered. You didn't have to.
The Houthis didn't have to
drag the country into conflict because they just didn't like Hadi. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, but obviously the people of Yemen don't want Hadi just replaced with another NATO-style proxy.
Have elections. There is a process that all Yemeni parties agreed to, including the Houthis, that we have a process. The process is that we end up with elections, and this is how you vote in a new government. You do not drag the country into conflict because you just don't like the sitting president. The UN panel of experts just January released about the amount of weapons have been going to the Houthis from Iran and the amount of money that has been going to the Houthis from Iran. So basically, the conflict has caused the Iranians even to support the Houthis even more.
The sources on the ground we were speaking to said the missiles and everything were sent way before because it's been blockaded.
Don't take this from me. This is the UN panel of experts who are tasked on reviewing weaponry coming into the country said that the Houthis have been receiving weapons and money via mediatory companies through selling of some oil by Iran. That's not me saying.
Obviously, the Iranian government deny that they're sending weapons, indeed, to
maybe they should explain it to the UN experts next time.
Well, speaking of UN, though, just finally, Israel is obviously on the side of Saudi Arabia in this conflict. The UN Human Rights Council have been criticizing Israel recently, and Jeremy Hunt has said that Israel will be, any measure from the Human Rights Council against Israel will be opposed by Britain. What do you think Britain's role is generally in the area of your expertise, really, as part of Reprieve, in the whole region?
I mean, I think the unfortunate situation is we have an ongoing bias towards Israel from the international community in general, where Britain is just part of that. You could see when the discussions, for example, happen even at the U.S. Congress, when the Congresswoman Ilhan Omar makes even the slightest comments, is not even accepted by policymakers.
She's been accused of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, which is, this is the unfortunate reality, that there is an ongoing bias towards Israel, which is not helping this conflict from being resolved anytime soon.
Barak Shaban, thank you.
Thank you.
The only time the world's arguably most efficient health service, the NHS, appears in the news at the moment is perhaps to drum up headlines about post-Brexit medicine shortages. But is the fury over Article 50 covering up a much greater scandal that has implications for everyone? Joining me now is NHS GP Dr. Bob Gill. He's the producer of the film The Great NHS Heist. Bob, thanks for coming back on. This deadline in May, why is it critical for all GPs in this country and for all people in England and Wales?
Well, general practice has, like the rest of the NHS, been underfunded since 2010, hidden under the austerity narrative. And what you have is GPs struggling to cope with increased workloads and a manpower crisis. So the government has engineered a desperate situation within primary care so that they will grab for additional resource. But what is hidden with this additional funding that is coming is a contract change. They want doctors to sign up to a network. And what these networks will be the building blocks of these American-style organizations. It's an attempt to grab the patient list and the budget that goes with it.
Okay, but people like Jeremy Corbyn's Shadow Health Secretary, John Ashworth, say, no, this is there are some good things about it. It integrates. That's why it's called integrated care systems. Do you think some people are just naive or innocent of the fact that integration means it's much easier for a big healthcare multinational to gobble it up?
Well, they've spent years disintegrating the NHS, breaking it up between purchaser and provider. But what the integration that Simon Stevens is proposing is the integration of budgets before they're handed over to the insurance companies. Integration of social care budgets, integration of NHS budgets. But social care, as we know, is mostly means tested, and there is also a charging infrastructure. So this will allow backdoor charging within the NHS. With the hostile environment, we have the infrastructure already being laid within the NHS to charge immigrants and supposed health tourists, which are not a burden on the NHS. The amount of money going there is minuscule. But they are putting in place an expensive infrastructure. What for? Because we're heading down the Letwin plan, which he spelt out back in 88, that we need to extend charging to the point of universality. And this is all part of this complex deception that is underway.
And just to remind us, that kind of integrated system that you are saying is being snuck in is like the United States one, the most inefficient, most expensive system with millions of people employed in useless administration.
Well, that's right. With the origins go back to 1971, where Edgar Kaiser made a proposal and the Nixon presidency adopted it. And the key point about it is the incentives. The incentives are to provide less medical care for the patient. So within this new network contract being proposed to GPs, there's something called the shared savings scheme. Now, for the first time, they're building in a perverse incentive for your doctor to not to refer you and to deny you care. Now, this is a major perversion and toxification, potentially, of the doctor-patient relationship.
And so when the government tells the GPs, thinking of voting right now or signing their documents, when they say 1.8 billion of taxpayers' money on course for the NHS, the structures are there basically to steal that money.
Well, you have United Health subsidiary Optum already embedded across the NHS. It's there in the administrative systems, the financial systems. They're also looking after patient data. So they are embedded already.
They wouldn't say steal, but what do you mean is...
Well, you have these intermediaries at the heart of the contracting.
Which so all the money leaks away.
Well, potentially they have to put their fees there, and we know that at the moment there is a lawsuit in America which is looking to sue UnitedHealth for defrauding the taxpayer to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, and that was done through a fraudulent algorithm that they managed to sell to Medicare, the state insurer. So that is in the courts at the moment. This is a potential for industrial scale fraud if we invite these American giant corporates into the NHS. But the other thing about the networks is GPs are being fooled into this is additional funding for potential existing work. But the reality is there's also a parallel program to significantly shrink the hospital system, cut beds further, cut 30 million outpatient appointments, and this work will be dumped onto the GPs. So this will be money with very dangerous strings attached and the loss of control of the patient and the budget that goes with it.
So you would certainly, your advice after that diagnosis is definitely to say don't sign the integrated care systems document. But there's also a class element to this, which is the way elites are being creamed off, and those people who might be able to be most articulate about what you're talking about, so they go to the private healthcare before even the final end of the NHS happens.
There is a drift, there's an erosion of trust. As you say, mainstream will cover one NHS failure after the other, which are genuinely happening. A&E departments are struggling. So the staff are losing trust with the system, the patients are losing trust, and eventually you will have a middle class drift over to the insurance system, and you have heavy advertising, you have more and more employers offering employer-based insurance. Once a critical mass has drifted over, then there will be the next step, which will be to withdraw more funding from people who can't afford private cover. But the targets of these reforms are not the poor and the sick. They will be abandoned. The targets are the middle classes for the premiums that they will be paying, and then in due course, if they become seriously ill and expensive, the insurers will look for a reason to dump them.
And this has been the plan for, I mean, we often talk about government incompetence and lack of organization. You're saying this is a conspiracy going back decades.
Well, there are key documents. You've got Oliver Letwin's document, Britain's Biggest Enterprise, which he wrote for the Centre for Policy Studies back in 1988. You have the Adam Smith Institute document, The Health of Nations, which spell out how to get from a public service to an insurance-based service over time without too many people noticing.
Okay, and just briefly, there is some hope, though. The Blair-Brown catastrophe years of PFI, new ways are now being sought for policies, say, under a Corbyn government or an opposition government, that those could be broken up, investigated for fraud and for malpractice, and it could be the end for those PFI companies.
Well, that's good news if it happens, because PFI has been a key strategy, which was a key tactic necessary to assist the land grab. Without that burden of debt, you couldn't justify a narrative to sell off publicly owned assets and say, well, you know, this land is now spare, we no longer need this hospital that we all publicly own, so we will demolish it and build luxury housing. That argument will be removed. That pressure, that cost pressure of PFI debts needs to be tackled in a way that doesn't pay off the creditors and doesn't leave the taxpayer deeply out of pocket.
Dr. Bob Gill, thank you.
Thanks very much.
And that's it for the show. We'll be back on Wednesday to speak to the architect of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, Cristina Figueres. Until then, keep in touch via social media. See you on Wednesday.